Wait until he went in search of Carrie? And then I heard something. Something that made my heart seem to stop and then stutter back to life twice as fast. The boat's engine was starting up. Panic washed over me like a cold sea wave, and I tried to think. We weren't moving yet. There was a chance the gangway was still down. I would have heard it being raised. I remembered that when we set out from Hull, the engine had hummed and thrummed for a good long time before we actually departed. But it was a ticking clock. How long did I have? Half an hour? A quarter? Perhaps less, given there were no passengers on board, no reason to hang about. I stood there, frozen in agonized indecision. Should I make a run for it? Was Richard asleep? I couldn't tell from the reflection in the balcony wall. It was too blurred and indistinct. Craning my head and moving as stealthily as I could, I peered around the edge of the veranda door into the silent room. But just as I did, he shifted and reached for a glass, then put it back down, and I whipped my head back, my heart thumping. Fuck! It must be 1 a.m. Why wasn't he asleep? Was he waiting for Carrie? But I had to get off the ship. I had to. I thought of the veranda windows, how they could be opened from the outside, how someone very brave or very stupid might scale the high glass wall between the verandas and gain entry to the next cabin. Once inside, I could just let myself out and then make a break for the gangway. I didn't care what story I had to spin when I got there. Somehow I would get off this boat. If not for me, then for Anne. And Carrie. No, fuck it. For me. I was getting off this boat for me. Because I had done nothing to deserve this, apart from being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I was damned if Bulmer was going to add me to the list of women he had screwed over. I looked down at myself, at the flowing, slippery lines of the kimono, impossible to climb in, and I untied the belt and shrugged off the soft silk. It fell to the floor with barely a whisper, and I picked it up, balled up the fabric as tight as I could, and tossed it over the privacy screen where it landed with a soft, barely perceptible flump. Then I looked up at the glass screen, towering above me, and swallowed. I was never going to be able to climb the privacy screen itself, that was clear. At least not without some serious equipment and or a ladder. But the glass wall overlooking the sea, that I probably could climb. It was rib height, and I was flexible enough to get one leg up and over and pull myself to sit astride it, and from there I could use the privacy screen to stand up. There was just one problem. It was over the sea. I'm not phobic about water, at least I never used to be. But as I looked over the edge at the dark waves sucking hungrily at the ship's hull, I felt my stomach shift and roll in a way not unlike seasickness. Shit. Was I really going to do this? Apparently, yes. I wiped my sweaty palms on the back of the lycra leggings and took a deep breath. It wouldn't be easy, I wasn't fooling myself, but it was possible. Carrie had done it, after all, to get into my cabin. If she could do it, so could I. I flexed my fingers, then very slowly I hooked one leg up onto the glass overlooking the sea, and using all the strength in my weak battery hen muscles, I pulled myself up so I was sitting astride the wall of glass. To my left was the cabin, its curtains pulled back, the veranda doors framing me in full view for anyone who turned their head to see. To my right was a sheer drop to the waters of the fjord below. I had no idea how far, but from this angle it looked like the equivalent of a 2- or 3-story house. I was not sure which side was more frightening. I just had to hope that my movements didn't attract Richard's attention. I swallowed and gripped the slippery glass with my legs, trying to get my courage up. I hadn't done the hard bit yet. That was coming. Shaking with fear and exertion, I got one foot up in front of me and I gripped the edge of the frosted privacy screen and hauled myself to standing. Now all I had to do was edge my body weight out, round the seaward side of the privacy glass, and swing myself to safety on the other side. All. Yeah, right. I took a deep breath, feeling my cold, sweaty fingers slip on the glass. There was no bloody purchase. Every other part of this boat was pimped up. Couldn't they have spared a little bling for the privacy glass? Just a few rhinestones, some fancy etching, something to give my fingers an edge to hang on to. I put one foot out, edging it round the high wall of glass, and I instantly knew the espadrilles had been a mistake. I had left them on, thinking that something to protect my feet and give me extra purchase on the glass would be no bad thing. But as my weight swung out over the water, I felt the sole of my supporting foot slip against the sharp edge. I gasped, and my fingers tightened desperately on the glass in front of me. If sheer willpower could have held me steady, I would have made it. I felt one nail break, then two, and then the glass seemed to be pulled out from between my scrabbling hands with a suddenness that left me unable to do anything, even scream. I felt the wind against my cheek for a brief, terrifying instant, my hair flapping in the darkness, my hands still clutching at the air. I was falling, falling backwards towards the fathomless waters of the fjord. I hit the blackness of the sea with a sound like a gunshot, a fierce, smacking blow that knocked all the breath from my lungs. I felt the air bubbling from my lungs as I plummeted through the stone-cold chill and the icy water strike through to my bones, and as I plunged deeper into fathomless black, I felt a silky current rise from far below, grip my feet, and pull. Chapter 33. I don't remember what I felt as I sank. Only the bone-cracking smack as I hit the sea, and the paralyzing cold of the water. But I do remember the gut-churning panic as the current seized me deep, deep below. Kick! I told my legs, feeling the breath sob in my throat. And I kicked. In the black and the cold, I kicked. First, because I didn't want to die, and then, as the black cold began to grip, because there was nothing else I could do. Because my lungs were screaming, and I knew that if I didn't break the surface soon, I would be dead. The current pulled and tugged at my legs with slippery fingers, trying to drag me deep into the darkness of the fjord, and I kicked and kicked with increasing desperation and despair. In the black, with the swirling currents of the water all around, it was almost impossible to tell which way was up. What if I was driving myself further into the depths? And yet, I didn't dare stop. The instinct to survive was too strong. "You're dying!" shouted a voice in the back of my head, and my legs had no other response except to kick and kick and kick. I shut my eyes against the salt sting, and against my closed lids, lights began to spark and shimmer, terrifyingly close to the shards of light and dark that fragmented my vision when I had a panic attack. But amazingly, unbelievably, when I opened my eyes again, I could see something. The pale, luminous shimmer of moonlight on water. For a second, I almost didn't believe it. But it was coming closer and closer, and the tug of the current on my body was loosening. And then I broke the surface with a breath that sounded closer to a scream, water streaming down my face, coughing and sobbing and coughing again. I was very close to the hull of the ship, close enough to feel the throb of the engines like a pulse through the water, and I knew that I had to start swimming. Not just because it was totally possible to die of hypothermia in really not very cold seas, but more urgently, because if the ship started moving while I was this close, nothing short of divine intervention would save me. and I'd had bad luck enough these past few days to make me think that if there was a god up there, he didn't like me very much. Shivering, I trod water and tried to get my bearings. I had surfaced at the front of the boat, and I could see a string of lights at the quayside and what I thought might be the dark shape of a ladder, although my streaming eyes made it difficult to be sure. It was hard to make my body obey. I was shaking so much that I could barely control my limbs, but I forced my arms and legs to start moving, and gradually began to swim towards the lights, coughing against the waves that slapped my face, feeling the chill of the water striking through to my bones, forcing myself to breathe slowly and deeply, though every part of my body wanted to gasp and pant at the physical assault of the cold. Something soft yet solid bumped against my face as I swam, and I shuddered. But it was more with cold than revulsion. I could worry about dead rats and decaying fish when I got to shore. Right now, the only thing I cared about was surviving. I could not have fallen in more than 20 or 30 yards from the quay, but now it seemed to be much further. I swam and swam, and at times I could swear the lights of the shore were getting further away, and other times they seemed almost close enough to grasp. But at last, I felt the rusted iron of the ladder bang against my numb fingers, and I was climbing and slipping and slipping and climbing, trying not to lose my grip as I hauled my wet and shuddering bones up the rungs. At the edge of the quay, I collapsed onto the concrete, gasping and coughing and shaking. After a moment, I got to my hands and knees and looked up, first at the Aurora, and then towards the little town in front of me. It wasn't Bergen, I had no idea where we were, but it was a small town, barely even a village, and this late at night there was not a soul about. The smattering of cafes and bars that lined the quayside were all closed. There were a few lights and shop windows, but the only establishment I could see that looked as if someone might open the door was a hotel overlooking the quay. Trembling, I got to my feet, lurched over the low chain that fenced off the sheer drop to the sea, and half walked, half staggered towards the hotel. The Aurora's engine had picked up a notch, and there was an urgency to it now. As I crossed the seemingly endless concrete apron of the quay, it rose again in pitch, and there was the sound of sloshing water. And as I glanced fearfully behind me, I saw the boat begin to move, its prow pointing out into the fjord, its motors grinding and thrumming as it inched slowly away from the shore. I looked quickly away, filled with a kind of superstition, as if just turning to look at the boat could attract the attention of the people on board. As I reached the steps up to the hotel door, the sound of the engine picked up again, and I felt my legs give way as I banged, banged, banged on the door. I heard a voice saying, "Please, please, oh please somebody come." And then the door opened, and the light and warmth flooded out, and I felt myself helped upright and over the threshold to safety. Some half an hour later, I was huddled in a wicker armchair, wrapped in a synthetic red blanket, in the dimly lit, glassed-in terrace overlooking the bay. I had a cup of coffee in my hands, but I was too tired to drink it. I could hear voices in the background, speaking in Norwegian, I supposed it must be. I was overwhelmingly tired. I felt as if I hadn't slept properly in days, which I hadn't. My chin kept nodding onto my chest and then jerking back up as I remembered where I was and what I'd escaped. Had it been real? The nightmare of the beautiful boat with its coffin-like cell far beneath the waves? Or was this all one long hallucination? I was half dozing, half watching the lights in the still blackness of the bay. The Aurora, a distant speck far up the fjord, moving west, when I heard a voice over my shoulder.
"Miss?"
I looked up. It was a man wearing a slightly skewed name tag, reading Eric Fossum, General Manager. He looked as if he had been dragged from his bed, his hair rumpled and his shirt buttons awry, and he passed a hand over an unshaven chin as he sat down in the armchair opposite.
Hello, I said wearily.
I'd gone through my story with the man at the desk, at least as much of it as I thought safe to give, and as much as his English would permit. He was obviously the night porter, and he looked and sounded more Spanish or Turkish than Norwegian, although his Norwegian seemed to be better than his English, which was fine when it came to stock phrases about checking in and opening hours, but wasn't up to a garbled tale of mixed identity and murder. I had seen him showing the only ID I had with me, Anne's, to the manager, and heard his low, guarded tones, and heard my own name repeated several times. Now the man sitting opposite me folded his fingers and smiled nervously.
Miss Blacklock? Is that right?
I nodded.
I don't completely understand. My night manager tried to explain, but how do you have Ann Bulmer's credit cards? We know Ann and Richard well. They stay here sometimes. Are you a friend?
I put my hands over my face as if I could press back the tiredness that was threatening to overwhelm me. It's a really long story. Please, can I use your phone? I have to contact the police. I had made up my mind as I hung, dripping and exhausted, over the polished check-in desk. In spite of my promise to Carrie, this was my only chance to save her. I didn't for one second believe that Richard would let her live. She knew too much, had screwed up too much. Without the headscarf, I had no chance of passing myself off as Anne, and without Carrie's passport, I had no chance of posing as Carrie, and both were lost somewhere in the bay, fathoms down. Only Anne's purse had survived, miraculously still in the pocket of the lycra stretch pants, as I crawled up the ladder out of the water.
Of course, Eric said, sympathetically. Would you like me to phone them? They may not have an English speaker on duty at this time of night, and I must warn you, we don't have a police station in the town. The nearest one is a few hours away in the next, the next valley. It will probably be tomorrow before someone can come out.
Please tell them it's urgent, though, I said wearily. The sooner the better. I can pay for a bed, I have money.
Let's not worry about that, he said with a smile. Can I get you another drink?
No, no thanks. Just please tell them to come soon. Someone's life could be in danger. I let my head rest heavy on my hand, my eyelids almost closing as he went back to the front desk, and I heard the sound of a phone receiver being lifted and the beep-beep-beep of a number being dialed. It sounded like a long one. Maybe the Norwegian version of 999 was different, or perhaps he was calling the local station. It rang. Someone at the other end picked up, and there was a brief exchange. Through the haze of exhaustion, I heard Eric saying something in Norwegian, out of which I could only pick the word hotel. Then a pause, and then another burst of Norwegian. Then I heard my own name given twice, and then Anne's.
Ja, din kun, Anne,
Eric said, as if the person on the other end had not heard correctly or had not believed what he'd heard. Then, more in Norwegian, and a laugh, and finally,
Tak, farvel, Richard.
My head jerked up from my supporting hand, and every part of me went suddenly cold and still. I looked out to the ships in the bay, to the Aurora, its lights disappearing in the far distance, and was it my imagination? It looked as if the ship had stopped. I sat for a moment longer, watching its lights, trying to measure them against the landmarks of the bay, and at last I was sure. The Aurora was no longer moving west up the fjord. It was turning around.
It was coming back.
Eric had hung up and was dialing another number now.
Politie, tak,
he said as someone answered. For a moment, I couldn't move, frozen with the realization of what I'd done. I hadn't believed Carrie's assertions about Richard's web of influence, not really. I'd dismissed them as the paranoia of a woman too beaten down to believe in the possibility of escape. But now, those fears seemed all too real. I set the coffee cup gently down on the table, let the red blanket fall to the floor, and, very quietly, I opened the terrace door and slipped outside into the night. Chapter 34. I ran through the winding streets of the little town, my breath tearing in my chest, stones cutting into my bare feet, making me wince with pain. The streets petered out, and the street lights began to disappear, but I ran on in the dark and the cold, stumbling through invisible puddles and over wet grass and graveled paths, until my feet grew too numb for me even to feel the cuts and the stones. Even then, I kept going, desperate to put as many miles as possible between myself and Richard Bulmer. I knew that I could not keep this up, that at some point I was going to have to give in, but my only hope was to keep going as long as possible until I found myself some kind of shelter. Finally, I could not run any more. I let myself drop back to a kind of gasping, limping jog, and then, as the lights of the village grew smaller in the distance, I slowed to a painful, stumbling walk. I was on a winding road that twisted into the darkness, climbing up the side of the fjord. Every few hundred yards, I looked back over my shoulder, down into the valley, to the shrinking speckle of lights on the little portside town, and to the dark slick of the fjord waters, where the lights of the aurora were coming closer. They were unmistakable now. I could see the ship clearly, and I could see, too, light beginning to tinge the sky above me. Dawn must be coming already. God, what day did that make it? Monday? But something seemed wrong, and after a few minutes I realized what it was. The lights were not to the east, but to the north. What I could see was not dawn, but the eerie green and gold streaks of the northern lights. The realization made me laugh. The bitter, mirthless choke that sounded shockingly loud in the still night air. What was it Richard had said? Everyone should see the northern lights before they died. Well, now I had. But it just didn't seem that important anymore. I had stopped for a moment, watching the shifting glory of the aurora. But now, at the thought of Richard, I began walking again. With each step, I remembered Carrie's frantic exhortations to get running and get out, her hysterical assertions about the reach of Richard's influence. It didn't seem so hysterical now. If only I had believed her. I should never have shown Anne's ID at the hotel, or trusted Eric with even the few details I'd given him. But I just hadn't quite believed that anyone, however wealthy, could have that kind of reach. Now I realized I was wrong. I groaned at my own stupidity, at the cold that was striking through my thin, damp clothes. Most of all, at the fact that I'd left the wallet on the desk. Stupid, stupid, stupid. That was 5,000 wet, soggy, but still usable kroner, and I'd left them there for Richard as a little golden hello when he turned up at the hotel. What was I going to do? I had no ID, nowhere to sleep, no means of buying so much as a bar of chocolate, let alone a train ticket. My best hope was finding a police station, but how? Where? And did I dare tell them the truth when I got there? I was just considering this
when I heard the roar of an engine behind me and turned to see a car coming round the bend, frighteningly fast, clearly not expecting anyone to be out here at this time of night. I scrambled for the verge, lost my footing and fell, sliding down a length of scree that left me bloodied and scraped, my leggings in tatters, and came to a halt with a splash in a pebbly ditch, some kind of stream or drainage channel down to the fjord below. The car itself had screeched to a halt on the road some 5 or 6 foot above me, the headlamps pointing out into the valley, the smoke from the exhaust billowing red in the rear lights. I heard the crunch of feet on the road above. Richard? Or one of his men? I had to get away. I tried to stand on my ankle, felt it give, and then tried again, more carefully this time. The pain made me give a sob. At the sound, a man's figure, lit from behind so that I could see his shape only in silhouette, peered over the edge of the road, and a voice said something in Norwegian. I shook my head. My hands were shaking.
I don't speak Norwegian.
I tried to keep the sob out of my voice.
Do you speak English?
Yes, I speak English,
the man said in a heavily accented voice.
Give me your hand. I will help you out.
I hesitated, but there was no way I could get out of the ditch without help, and if the man really intended to hurt me, he could just as easily climb down here and attack me in the shelter of the ditch. Better to get out, where I could at least run if I had to. The lights of the car shone in my eyes, blinding me, and I put my hand up, shielding them against the glare. All I could see was a dark shape and a halo of blonde hair beneath some kind of cap. It wasn't Richard, at least. That I was sure of.
Give me your hand,
the man said again, with a touch of impatience this time.
Are you hurt?
No, I'm not hurt, I said. At least my ankle hurts, but I don't think it's broken.
Put the leg there.
He pointed at a rock about a foot out of the ditch.
And I will pull you up.
I nodded, and with a feeling that I might be doing something very stupid, I set my good foot to the rock and leaned upward with my right hand. I felt the man grab hold of my wrist, his grip immensely strong, and with a grunt he began to pull, bracing himself against a rock at the edge of the ditch. The muscles and sinews in my arm were screaming in protest, and when I tried to put my weight on my bad foot, I cried out. But at last, with a painful, scrambling rush, I was up and out of the ditch and standing trembling on the edge of the verge.
"What are you doing out here?"
the man said. I couldn't see his face, but there was concern in his voice.
Are you lost? Have you had an accident? This road leads directly up the mountain. It's no place for a tourist.
I was trying to think of how to answer when I realized two things. The first was that he was carrying something in a holster at his hip, the shape of it silhouetted against the car lights. And the second was that the car itself was a police car. As I stood there, frozen, trying to think what to say, I heard the crackle of a radio pierce the night. I managed. The policeman took a step forward, tipping his cap so that he could see me more clearly, and frowned.
What is your name, miss?
I said, and then stopped. There was another crackle from his radio, and he held up a finger.
One moment, please.
He put his hand to his hip, and I saw that what I had taken for a gun was actually a police radio in a holster, hanging next to a pair of handcuffs. He spoke briefly into the receiver, and then climbed into the driver's side of the car and began a longer conversation on the car radio.
Ja,
I heard, and then a burst of conversation I didn't understand. Then he looked up at me through the windscreen, and his eyes met mine, his gaze puzzled.
Ja,
he said again.
Det är riktig, Laura Blacklock.
Everything seemed to slow down.
and I knew with a cold certainty that it was now or not at all. If I ran now, I might be making a mistake, but if I didn't, I might not live to find out, and I could not afford to take that risk. I hesitated for just 1 second more, and then I saw the policeman replace the radio receiver and reach for something in his glove compartment. I had no idea what to do, but I had not believed Carrie before, and it had nearly cost me everything. Screwing up my courage for the pain I knew was coming, I began to run. Not up the road, as before, but down, cross-country, scrambling headlong down the vertiginous side of the fjord. Chapter 35. It was growing light when I realized that I could go no further, that my muscles, exhausted beyond endurance, just simply would not obey me. I was no longer walking. I was stumbling as if I was drunk, my knees buckling when I tried to climb over a fallen tree stump. I had to stop. If I didn't, I would fall where I stood, so deep in the Norwegian countryside that my body might never be found. I needed shelter, but I had left the road a long time back and there were no houses to be seen. I had no phone, no money. I didn't even know what time it was, although it must have been close to dawn. A sob rose in my dry throat. But just at that moment, I saw something loom from between the sparse trees, a long, low shape. Not a house, but some kind of barn, perhaps? The sight gave my legs a last shot of energy, and I staggered out from between the trees, across a dirt track and through a gate in a wire fence. It was a barn, although the name seemed almost too grand for the shack that lay in front of me, with its rickety wooden walls and corrugated iron roof. Two shaggy little horses turned their heads curiously as I trudged past, and then one of them returned to drinking from what I saw with a leap of my heart was a trough of water, its surface pink and gold in the soft dawn light. I staggered to the trough, falling on my knees in the short grass beside it, and cupping the water in my hands, I drank great gulps of it down. It was rainwater, and it tasted of mud and dirt and rust from the metal trough, but I didn't care. I was too thirsty to think about anything except slaking my parched throat. When I'd drunk as much as I could, I straightened up and looked around me. The shed door was shut, but as I put my hand to the latch, it swung open, and I went cautiously through, shutting the door behind me. Inside there was hay, bales and bales of it, some tubs that I thought might be feed or supplements, and, hanging on the wall on pegs, a couple of horse blankets. Slowly, drunk with weariness, I pulled the first one down and laid it over the deepest pile of hay, not even thinking about rats or fleas or even Richard's men. There was surely no way they could find me here, and I had got to the stage where I almost didn't care. If they would just let me rest, they could take me away. Then I lay down on the makeshift bed and drew the other blanket over the top of me. And then I slept.
Hello?
The voice in my head spoke again, painfully loud, and I opened my eyes to a blinding light and a face gazing into mine. An elderly man with a full white beard and a strong resemblance to Captain Birdseye was peering at me with rheumy hazel eyes and a mix of surprise and concern. I blinked and scrambled backwards, my heart thudding painfully, and then tried to get to my feet, but my ankle gave a wrench of pain and I stumbled. The man took my arm saying something in Norwegian, and without thinking, I jerked it savagely out of his grip and fell back onto the floor of the barn. For a few minutes, we just looked at each other, him taking in my scrapes and cuts, me looking at his lined face, and the dog barking and circling behind him.
"Come,"
he said at last, getting painfully up from his crouch and holding out his hand with cautious calm, as if I were a wounded animal that might snap at any provocation, and not a human at all. The dog barked again, hysterically this time, and the man shouted something over his shoulder that was clearly,
"Quiet, you!"
"Who?" I licked dry lips and tried again. "Who are you? Where am I?"
"Konrad Horst," the man said, pointing at himself.
He pulled out his wallet and flicked through until he found a photo of an elderly lady with rosy cheeks and a bun of white hair, cuddling two blonde-haired little boys.
"Min kone,"
he said, enunciating slowly, and then, pointing to the children, something that sounded like
"Vori bonbon."
Then he pointed out of the barn door at an extremely elderly Volvo parked outside.
"Bilen min,"
he said, and again,
"Kom."
I didn't know what to do. There was something reassuring about the photos of his wife and grandchildren, but even rapists and killers had grandkids, right? On the other hand, maybe he was just a nice old man. Maybe his wife would speak English. At the very least, they'd likely have a phone. I looked down at my ankle. I didn't have much choice. It had swollen to twice its usual size, and I wasn't sure I could even hobble as far as the car, let alone make it to an airport. Captain Birdseye held out his arm and made a little gesture.
"Police?"
he rumbled interrogatively, as if giving me a choice. But it was an illusion. I had no choice. I let him help me to my feet, and I got into the car. It was only as we drove that I realized quite how far I had run the night before. You couldn't even see the fjord from this wooded fold of the hillside, and the Volvo must have jolted down several miles of rutted track before we reached the semblance of a road. We were turning onto the tarmac when I noticed something in the little well beneath the radio. A mobile phone. It was very, very ancient, but it was a phone. I put out my hand, hardly able to breathe.
"May I?"
Captain Birdseye looked across and then grinned. He put the phone in my lap, but then tapped the screen saying something in Norwegian. As soon as I looked at the phone, I realized what he was saying. There was no reception at all.
"Vente,"
he said loudly and clearly, and then slowly, in what sounded like heavily accented English,
"wait."
I held the phone in my lap, watching the screen with a lump in my throat as the trees flashed past. But something didn't make sense. The date on the phone showed 29th of September. Either I was miscounting, or I had lost a day. "This," I pointed to the date on the phone, "today is really the 29th. Captain Birdseye glanced at the screen and then nodded.
"Ja, schwinjune, Tuesday,"
he said, enunciating the word very slowly. Tuesday. Today was Tuesday. I had been asleep in that little hut for a full day and a night. I was just computing that and trying not to think about how worried Judah and my parents must be when we turned into the driveway of a neat little blue-painted house and something flickered in the corner of the phone screen. A single bar of reception. "Please?" I held it up, my heart suddenly beating so hard in my throat that the words felt choked and strange in my mouth.
"Can I call my family in England?"
Konrad Horst said something in Norwegian that I didn't understand, but he was nodding, and so, With fingers that shook so hard I could hardly find the right keys, I pressed +44 and dialed the number of Judah's mobile phone. Chapter 36. We said nothing for the longest time. We just stood in the middle of the airport like two fools, holding each other. Judah touching my face and my hair, and the bruises on my cheek like he truly couldn't believe it was me. I suppose I was probably doing the same to him, I can't remember. All I could think was, I'm home. I'm home. I'm home. I can't believe it, Judah kept saying. You're okay. And then the tears started, and I began to cry into the harsh, scratchy wool of his jacket, and he didn't say anything at all, just held me like he'd never let me go. At first, I hadn't wanted the Horsts to call the police, but I couldn't make them understand that, and after I'd spoken to Judah, and he had promised to call Scotland Yard with my story, a story so improbable that I almost didn't believe it myself, I began to accept that not even Richard Bulmer could buy his way out of this one. When the police arrived, they took me to a health centre to get treatment for my cut feet and wrenched ankle, and a prescription for my medication. It seemed to take forever, but at last the doctors pronounced me fit enough to leave, and the next thing I knew, I was being driven to a police station up the valley where an official from the British Embassy in Oslo was waiting. Again and again I found myself reciting the story of Anne and Richard and Carrie, and each time it sounded more and more implausible to my own ears. You have to help her, I kept saying. Carrie, you have to go after the boat. The British official and the police officer exchanged a look, and the policeman said something in Norwegian. I knew, suddenly, that whatever it was they were holding back, it was not good news. What? I asked. What is it? What's wrong?
The police have found two bodies, the embassy official said at last, his voice awkward and formal. The first in the early hours of Monday morning, dredged up by a fishing boat. The second, later on Monday, recovered by police divers.
I put my head in my hands, grinding my fingers into my eyes, watching the pressure build and bloom as flames and sparks on the inside of my lids. I drew a deep breath. Tell me, I looked up. I have to know.
The body recovered by divers was a man,
the embassy official said slowly.
He had been shot through the temple. The police believe it may have been a self-inflicted wound. He had no ID on him, but they are presuming it to be the body of Richard Bulmer. He was reported missing from the Aurora by the crew.
And I swallowed. And the other?
The other was a woman, very slim, with shorn hair. The police will have to conduct a post-mortem, but the preliminary findings are that she was drowned. Miss Blacklock?
He looked around nervously, as if unsure what to do.
Are you all right, Miss Blacklock? Can someone get her a tissue, please? Please don't cry, Miss Blacklock. You're all right now.
But I couldn't speak. And the worst of it was that he was right. I was all right. But Carrie was not. It should have been a comfort that Bulmer had killed himself, but I couldn't find any. I just sat there, crying into the tissue they gave me, and thinking of Carrie and everything she'd done to me and for me. Whatever the rights and wrongs, she had paid with her life. I hadn't been fast enough to save her. Chapter 37. The taxi from the airport took us back to Judah's. We didn't discuss it exactly, but somehow I couldn't face my basement flat. I'd had enough of being shut up in lightless rooms, and Judah seemed to realize that. In his living room, he tucked me up on the couch with a blanket as if I were a small child or someone recovering from an illness, and he kissed me very gently on my forehead, like I might break.
"I can't believe you're home," he said again.
"When they showed me your boots in that photo..."
His eyes welled up, and I felt my own throat scratch with tears. "She took them," I said croakily. "So I could pretend to be her. She..." But I couldn't finish. Judah held me for a long time, and then when he could speak, he swallowed and said,
You've got a lot of messages, you know. People have been calling me because your voicemail got full up. I've been writing them down."
He felt in his pocket and handed me a list. I scanned down it. Most of them were names I would have expected. Lissy, Rowan, Emma, Jen. One or two were a surprise. "Tina West. Very relieved you're safe. No need to call back. Chloe Jansen. Hopes you're okay. Please call if there is anything she or Lars can do. Ben Howard. No message."
God, Ben.
I felt a stab of guilt. I'm surprised he's speaking to me. I more or less accused him of being behind all this. Did he really call?
"That's not the half of it,"
Judah said, and I saw him wipe his eyes surreptitiously on his T-shirt.
"He was the one who raised the alarm. He called me from Bergen trying to find out if you'd made it home okay, and when I said I hadn't heard from you since Sunday, he told me to call the UK police and tell them it was a matter of urgency. He said he'd been raising hell since Trondheim and no one on the crew would listen to him."
"Don't make me feel worse."
I put my hands over my face.
"Hey, he's still a self-important little shit," Judah said.
He gave me his endearing smile, and I saw with a pang that his tooth had rerooted.
"And he did give a pretty crappy interview to the Mail, which made it sound like you two had barely just broken up."
"Okay," I said with a shaky laugh. "That makes me feel a bit better about accusing him of murder.
Look, do you want a cup of tea?"
I nodded, and he got up and made his way to the kitchen. I took a handful of tissues out of a box on the coffee table and wiped my eyes, then picked up the remote control and turned on the television, trying for some semblance of normality. I was just scrolling through the channels, looking for something reassuring and familiar, a Friends rerun maybe, or How I Met Your Mother, when I stopped dead, my heart in my mouth. My eyes were fixed on the television screen, at the man staring out at me. It was Bulmer. His eyes were locked onto mine, his mouth quirked in that asymmetric smile, and for a second I thought I might be hallucinating. I drew a breath, ready to scream for Judah, ask him if he could see the face staring out of the screen at me like a nightmare. But then it cut back to a newsreader, and I realized what was happening. It was a report of Bulmer's death. "Breaking news of the death of British businessman and peer Lord Richard Bulmer. Lord Bulmer, who was the majority shareholder in the troubled Northern Lights Group, has been found dead after being reported missing just hours earlier from his luxury yacht, the Aurora, off the coast of Norway." The screen cut again, this time to Richard, standing on a podium as he gave some kind of address. His lips were moving, but his speech was muted so that the newsreader could carry on narrating over the top of the images. And as the camera zoomed on his face, I found myself turning down the volume, leaving the couch, and kneeling in front of the TV, my face just inches from his. When the talk came to an end, Richard bowed, and the camera went close up on his face, and he looked straight out of the screen and gave me his characteristic little wink, so that my stomach turned and my skin crawled. I picked up the remote with shaking hands, ready to exorcise him from my life once and for all, when the camera panned, and I saw a woman seated in the front row, smiling and applauding, and I paused, my finger hovering over the off button. She was extraordinarily beautiful, with a long river of dark gold hair and broad cheekbones, and for a moment I couldn't think where I had seen her before, and then I realized. She was Anne. Anne, as she had been before Richard was through with her, young and beautiful and alive. As she applauded, she seemed suddenly to realize that the cameras were on her, and her eyes flickered towards the lens, and I saw something there, although whether it was my imagination or not, it was hard to tell. It seemed to me that there was something sad in her expression, something a little trapped and afraid. But then she smiled more broadly and put her chin up, and I saw that this was a woman who would never capitulate, never give way, a woman who would fight to the last. Then the picture changed, and we were back in the newsroom, and I turned off the screen and went back to the couch. I drew the blanket over me and turned my face to the wall, listening to Judah making tea in the next room. Thinking. The clock on Judah's bedside table showed gone midnight. We were lying together, his chest moulding to my spine, his arm around me, holding me close, as if he didn't trust me not to disappear in the night. I had waited until I thought he was asleep before I let myself cry, but when a particularly big sob shook my ribs, he spoke, soft and low against my ear.
Are you okay? I thought you were asleep.
My voice came out cracked and hoarse with tears.
Are you crying?
I wanted to deny it, but my throat had closed up and I couldn't speak, and anyway, I'd had enough of lies and pretending. I nodded, and he put his hand up, feeling the wetness on my cheeks.
Oh, honey.
I heard the movement of his throat as he swallowed.
It'll be... You don't have to...
He stopped, unable to continue.
I can't stop thinking about her,
I said against the ache in my throat. It was easier not looking at him, speaking to the quiet darkness and the slivers of moonlight across the floor.
I can't accept it. It's all wrong.
Because he killed himself? Judah asked.
Not just that. Anne. And Carrie.
Judah said nothing, but I knew what he was thinking.
Say it,
I said bitterly. He sighed, and I felt his chest rise and fall against my spine, his breath warm against my cheek.
I probably shouldn't say this, but I can't help but feel glad.
I twisted round under the sheets to look at him, and he held up a hand.
I know it's wrong, but what she did to you? Honestly, if it had been up to me, I wouldn't have dredged her out. I'd have left her there for the fishes. It's probably a good thing it wasn't my decision.
I felt anger rise up inside me. Anger on behalf of Carrie, beaten and bullied and lied to.
She died because of me, I said. She didn't have to let me go.
Bullshit. You were only there because of her. She didn't have to kill a woman and lock you up.
You don't know that. You don't know what goes on in other people's relationships.
I thought of Carrie's terror, of the bruises on her body, of her belief that she would never escape Richard. She had been right.
Judah said nothing. I couldn't see his expression in the dark, but I felt his silent disagreement.
What? I demanded. You don't believe me? You don't think people can be sucked into doing something out of fear or an inability to see any other way out?
No, it's not that, Judah said slowly.
I believe that. But I still think, in spite of it all, we're responsible for our own actions.
We all get scared. But you can't tell me that you do that to another person, no matter how tough things seemed. Lock them up like that, imprison them, no matter how scared you were.
I don't know, I said. I thought of Carrie, of how brave she had been, and how fragile. I thought of the masks she wore to hide the terror and loneliness inside. I thought of the bruise on her collarbone, and the fear in her eyes. I thought of how she had given up everything for me.
Listen. I sat up and wrapped the sheet around me.
That job you were talking about before I left, the one in New York, did you turn it down?
Yes. I mean, well, no. I'm going to. I haven't called them yet. After you went missing, it kind of slipped my mind.
Why? Judah's voice was suddenly uneasy.
Because I don't think you should. I think you should take it.
What?
He sat up too, and a shaft of moonlight fell across his face, showing me an expression full of shock and anger. For a minute, he didn't seem to know what to say. Then the words came pouring out.
What the hell? Why? Where has this come from?
Well, this is a chance in a lifetime, right? It's the post you've always wanted.
I twisted the sheet around my fingers, cutting off the blood until they went numb and cold.
And let's face it, there's nothing holding you here, is there?
Nothing holding me here?
I heard him swallow, saw his fists clench and unclench against the white sheets.
I have everything holding me here. At least, I thought I did. Are you breaking up with me?
What?
Now it was my turn for shock. I shook my head and took his hands, rubbing my fingers across the sinews and the bones of his knuckles, hands that I knew by heart.
Fuck.
Jude, no. Not in a million years. I'm trying to ask.
Let's go. Together.
But Velocity, your job... Rowan's maternity cover. This is your big chance. I can't screw that up for you.
It's not my big chance, I sighed.
I slid down beneath the sheets, still holding Judah's hands in mine.
I realized that when I was on the boat.
I've spent, what, nearly 10 years working at Velocity, while Ben and everyone else took a risk, went on to bigger and better stuff, and I didn't.
I was too scared.
And I felt like I owed them for standing by me when things were bad.
But Rowan's never going to leave. She'll be back in 6 months, maybe less. And I've got nowhere to go.
And the truth is, even if I did pull myself up the ladder, it's not what I want anymore.
I never wanted it.
I realized that on board the boat. God knows I had enough time to think about it.
What do you mean? It's... ever since we met, it's all you've talked about.
I think I lost sight of what I wanted. I don't want to end up like Tina and Alexander, traveling from country to country and only seeing 5-star hotels and Michelin restaurants. Yes, Rowan's been to half the luxury resorts in the Caribbean, but in return, she spends her life reporting the stories that people like Bulma... want her to tell. And I don't want that. Not anymore. I want to write about the things people don't want you to know. And if I'm going to start pulling my way up from the bottom again, well, I can freelance from anywhere. You know that.
A thought came to me, and I let out a shaky, involuntary laugh.
I could write a book. My floating prison. True life hell on the seven seas.
Low, Judah took my hands, his eyes wide and dark in the moonlight.
Lo, stop joking. Are you serious about this?
I took a deep breath. Then I nodded. I've never been more serious in my life. Afterwards, Judah fell asleep, his head in the crook of my shoulder in a way